Again, my name is Allison Lionheart. I'm originally from Des Moines, Iowa, recent Chandler School Theology grad. And so we're going to talk today about ecofeminist theology, particularly ecofeminist theology in a global context, and then how different contexts in the U.S. prompt different responses. So since we're a small group, if we could go around, just say our name, where we're from, and then any questions we have or what we hope to get out of the session. That would be great. We could start with you, and we'll just move this way.
I'm leaving this afternoon, but first time here. I'm from Seattle originally, Ballard, Seattle. It's kind of a Norwegian community, an ethnic neighborhood. Then we moved 23 times in the last 59 years.
Yeah.
Overseas and everywhere.
Been around. Do you have any questions about ecofeminist theology or anything you hope to get out of?
Well, I was at chalet number two. There were two ladies, real nice young ladies that were, I think they were giving this lecture several days ago.
Okay.
And but I didn't know too much about it. I've been busy hiking or doing other things.
Okay. A lot to do here.
I'm Callie. I grew up in Colorado and then went to college in Iowa at Luther College in Decorah. And I've spent the past 5 years living and working in Chicago at interfaith environmental organization there. Several of my coworkers, one in particular, had a very strong eco-feminist lens, but I don't know very much about eco-feminist theology, so I just wanted to know more.
I'm Ruth Tilquist. I live in St. Paul. I've lived in Minnesota all but 3 years of my life. Oh, 3 and a half. I'm a retired elementary teacher. And I know very little about ecofeminist theology, so I'm here to learn.
That's good.
Paul Tilquist, same bio. I know nothing. I mean, you know, I know a little bit about feminist theology, but eco-feminist theology? Never heard of it.
Right.
So here we are, ready to soak it up.
Yeah. My question is, are you going to talk about how female pastors have grown up in the last several years and some of the things they had to go through with, you know, different people, Missouri Synod, of course, does not have Missouri pastors.
Not so much.
But more of a recent phenomenon, right?
Yeah. Ecofeminist theology kind of goes beyond just female pastors, so it's more of an all-society lens you can take with it. So if you want to, we can bring that up later during the questions and reflection time. But
it's fascinating because I'm with Pastor Doug Peterson and his wife. They're both pastors. And their folks were also here a few days ago. They were also retired pastors, both man and woman. And Tiger, her name was. And all the problems she had, even with the Lutheran pastors and giving communion and going to seminary. And she was kind of a real forerunner of female pastors. It was a fascinating story.
Yeah. Can confirm that still has troubles today as a recent seminarian. I will get a stop before I get started on that subject. So, ecofeminist theology. Okay. So, I think it's easiest to break it down to what is ecofeminism. And so, ecofeminism formally emerged in kind of the 1960s, 1970s, when the environmental movement and the second wave feminist movement were coming up. And it looks at the interrelated domination of both nature and women. And so I think a term that really is a good analogy to think about this interrelated domination is Mother Nature. So nature is often feminized, I believe is the right word, and both mothers and nature have been seen as something to be controlled. For example, women are always kept in the household, at least traditionally, over the past 100 to 50 years, that's starting to change. Yeah, what women can do legally is also a big question, and also nature is seen as this thing to be controlled. You see that especially with sort of this move westward. I'm, again, from the Midwest, and so they tried to get rid of all the predatory animals. So, for example, the bobcat, and it's only recently they're starting to come back. And another example is in the Adirondacks of upstate New York. They hunted all the moose out of that area because they saw nature as something to be controlled and something that this is for human enjoyment, not a more holistic symbiotic relationship that people have recently started to try to adopt. So, I'm trying to think if there's anything. Yeah, and another analogy is if you think about suburbia, lawns are a great example of how we try to control nature. We bring this non-native plant, we mow it, we have it in a nice, neat row with the sidewalks. Lawns are nice, especially to walk on with bare feet, but it is a way that we try to control nature. And allow trees in neighborhoods, landscaping is also a way we try to control nature. And as well, especially you can think of like the typical 1950s suburbia, again, women were in these homes, in these controlled natural environments. Again, this interrelated domination of women and nature. And so where the theology piece comes in is reconciling where we as people of faith or the church have been complicit, have promoted this interrelated domination, and where we can respond and fight against it. So you can look at scripture and have a reinterpretation of scripture. You can look at systems of church hierarchy and sort of look at that through an ecofeminist lens and say, how are we going to change this to not perpetuate this domination? Is everyone with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Okay. So, a good word to use is the logic of domination. This term was coined by Karen Warren, and it describes the hierarchy that we have in society that's based off of gender, race, sexual orientation, etc., and how those at the top of the totem pole dominate those at the bottom, and that's how we operate in society. And so, again, ecofeminist theology is pushing against that. And then another helpful way to think about this field is as a roundabout, where there's a lot of cars coming in, a lot of cars going out from different directions. Sometimes you gotta shut down a street and repave it, and then other times the alleyway branches off from this roundabout. And so it's kind of, if you look at it from a whole and you're like, what's going on? There's a lot of different pieces within it that you can explore. And if you're
gotta make sure you know who has the right of way. In Great Britain, they drive on the wrong side of the road. And around about it, you got to make sure you look right for the day of the right of way instead of left.
Well, that's a good tie-in, because today we're going to be looking at ecofeminist theology in different perspectives. So if you approach that roundabout, do you look left or right to make sure there's enough traffic? So that's what we'll be exploring today.
That also goes with walking across the street. Yeah. We normally look left for oncoming traffic. In London or anywhere in Great Britain, you have to look right. That's very important.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm going to start us off by reading some scripture, and it's just some scripture I want us to just kind of keep in the back of our mind as we go through our lesson today. So it's from Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 12. Now the man named his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand." So, we'll come in later, but just sort of to start us off with a bit of scripture. And so to give some very brief background on the feminist movement and that happened in the U.S., and I'm going to use that as a jumping point to then see how the feminist movement in the U.S. interacts with ecofeminism globally. All right? So, we have feminism is sort of seen as coming in waves. So, first wave was early 1900s, and this was a lot of concentration on women getting the right to vote. Doesn't have too much impact with ecofeminist theology, just sort of kind of a good background to know. Second wave is where ecofeminist theology comes in. This was in the 1960s to about 80s. And this was a lot of like, "I am woman, hear me roar." You know, you spell women with a Y to kind of exclude the men out from it. More kind of militant, you know, gotta break the stained glass ceiling. And I think a lot of people, when they think that feminists hate men, are referring back to second wave feminism, and I can tell you right now that it's not true.
What were the names names of women in the 60s attached to that? Gloria Steinem, Phyllis Schlafly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Gloria Steinem.
Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are reading them all. Right.
For theologians, it'd be like Rosemary Radford Ruther, Mary Daly, people.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this is definitely ecofeminist theology came out of this wave. You have third wave, which was the 1990s. This was like riot girl grunge. Definitely went along with like the Nirvana time. That was the... And again, this doesn't really have a whole lot to do with ecofeminism. And then arguably right now we're in fourth wave, to be determined what that wave is characterized by. And so again, really concentrating on the second wave. Academics in America were starting to write about feminist theology during that time. And then other women in other countries started to write about, well, we have feminism, but this is how it interacts with our context. And so, one example of this is in Latin America, where feminist theology really was integrated within liberation theology. When I say liberation theology, do we know what I'm talking about? Can anyone give me a definition? Or what they think liberation theology is? If not,
I can. Equal opportunity?
Okay, a little bit. I think all of this is trying to get to equal opportunity. But liberation theology, similar era, and it was concentrating on economics. So who is Jesus for the poor? And Jesus kind of counteracting these. Jesus would not want this hierarchy in which there's people below who are just servants to these people higher up in the hierarchy. So a lot of concentration on, Jesus for the poor, Jesus as a servant,
language.
Yeah. Well, what comes to my mind is the male domination, the hierarchical systems that liberation theology railed against to take down those artificial hierarchies and dominance. So concentration on the poor, et cetera.
Yeah.
Poor and disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, getting back to New Testament, Paul, for example, wasn't he pretty male chauvinistic back in his day?
Oh. Yeah.
Paul is just...
That might have been a cultural thing, too.
Yeah, for me, Paul is good at Christ crucified, and if he gets outside of that lane, he just kind of... I'm like, you know, Paul, you and I are not that great.
Oh, I
don't
if you're like
preaching
it
gospel, it's good. If you're preaching anything else... I don't know, but yeah, and what's interesting is people always quote Paul, and I'm like, but don't we follow Jesus? Anyway, gonna stop long ahead on that one. also, what's interesting about liberation theology in Latin America is its interaction with communism that was happening during that time. So again, with communism trying to break down social class and liberation theology. Sort of trying to do the same thing. Again, it's very much from like an economic, socioeconomic class lens. And so when ecofeminists from Latin America were starting to write, their big critique of liberation theology was, okay, you're talking about socioeconomic class, you don't mention women at all. And that was a huge chunk that they were missing. And so that was the challenge for a lot of Latin American ecofeminists, was to incorporate gender, especially in a lot of these countries that were more Catholic-dominated. So you had a lot of male priests, and they were saying, okay, these male priests are helping out the poor, but how are they helping out the women? So that was their main critique of that.
I was trying to think if that was the era when Pope Francis was very interested in the poor, but I don't read in that area, but women would not, it would appear, did not come to his mind. It was more the poor.
Yeah.
And not necessarily women.
Yeah. And, yeah.
That just came to mind, because that was the era in which he was working with the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But...
yeah, he would be a good example of he's doing good things, but the feminists of Latin America want to push it even further.
Yeah, he was missing a piece.
Yeah, he was missing a piece. And they were also missing the eco part as well. And how does this logic of domination that you're addressing from a socioeconomic standpoint, you also need to address it from a gender and an earth standpoint. And so a lot of their writing... critique liberation theology and try to bring it along further. And so, probably my go-to person with that is Yvonne Guevara, if you want names, look up later. And she has Longing for Running Water. And so, the way she addresses the pieces that are missing in liberation theology, here you can look at it if you want.
Are you going to theology regarding women in the church, like the month of the Missouri Synod, for example, or Wisconsin Synod, or the Mormons?
We can do that later. But she, the way she addressed the pieces that are missing is she just tore the rug out from everything theological and just put a whole new lens on God, Jesus, Trinity, things of that nature. So, do we have any questions thus far on... ecofeminist theology from more of a Latin American
tradition. Are you going to talk about, there's countries, Southeast Asia or down South Asia, where the women are really in charge of everything, the household, family. There's a word for that, isn't it? For the female, it's more, dominant. There's some countries back in the world that do that.
Yes, but when it comes to
particularly through colonization, they may be matriarchs in society and everyday life, but when it comes to who holds political and sometimes religious power, it's often male-dominated because through colonization, Western ideals, Western European ideals of who belongs in what sphere has been translated onto their culture. So a lot of these women in Latin America or Southeast Asia, when they're writing about ecofeminist theology, they have to come at it from a double layer of, traditionally, what have we believed? What has been pressed on us through colonization? And then how do we deal with all of that? And so it's more multi-layered than, say, for me, a white woman in the U.S. who has privilege. I wouldn't have to go through as many layers as so, yeah, and what's interesting about Yvonne Guevara is she is a Catholic sister. So she really, yeah, again, it just has more layers to write about. Yeah, so other examples of ecofeminist theology that in different parts of the world are, there's definitely an ecofeminist movement in India, and so this is a lot of women saying, okay, you're wanting to cut down these trees and dam these rivers, and we're the ones in charge of feeding our kids, and we're not going to be able to do that if you have these negative environmental impacts. And so that's, they come at it from more of a, I'm responsible for feeding my family, and I can't do that. Or that's going to plunge us into poverty if you dam this river and flood our fields. So again, sort of a different perspective than someone in the U.S. living in a house that already has landscaping and is not impacted on whether the river is dammed upstream or not. So, working for women's rights in India also includes land rights. So a lot of times women can't own land, and so, but if they do, they have more power and status in society, so kind of trying to rework owning of land so women can own land and they're less at risk for domestic violence and that sort of stuff. So that's how ecofeminist theology relates in that context. And another example is there's a Chilean group called Conspirado. I'm not sure what Spanish is that is for, I don't know Spanish, but that's a gathering of women who have more female feminine language in their church services, and they also talk about environmental issues. And so, yeah, ecofeminist theology in other contexts can be just women gathering together as well. And then yet another example is Canadian women working on sustainability with the fishing industry, which is traditionally a male-dominated field. And so, again, then reworking that logic of domination and saying, okay, we still need to fish and feed our families, but what's the way we can do it sustainably, in which we're not just pulling willy-nilly resources from the earth, but respect that there's a give-and-take relationship between us and nature. And coming back in the States, you see ecofeminist theology with a lot of indigenous women drawing attention to an acronym is Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. And so, and Native women are at like a 2 to 3 times higher rate of domestic violence than women of other races. And so a good example of this is, I believe it's Kimberly Loring Heavyrunner. She's part of the Blackfeet Nation, and which is next to Glacier National Park, where I worked at last summer. And her sister Ashley went missing in 2017, I believe, and she's been raising a lot of awareness about Ashley's disappearance and overall women missing, Indigenous women that are missing, like going to Congress and speaking. And so for them, again, ecofeminist theology would have that added layer of our tradition has an integrated view with the earth, And then again, with this colonization of the U.S., how do we still live within that, but kind of fight against it as well?
Governor Walz in Minnesota has just reactivated a committee to study this, the missing Indigenous women in Minnesota, because we have, you know, many tribal nations in Minnesota, and many women have disappeared. So there's going to be a study. There was a study, and then it closed down, and now he's reactivated it with a committee. And we have a Native American as a lieutenant governor, and I think she probably had something to do with reactivation of the the study.
Yeah, and you see, I think there were 5 Native women elected to either the House of Representatives, like somewhere in Congress. And so yeah, you see a lot of energy coming around this movement recently, which I think is great. Probably need to draw attention to. So these are from Latin America to the U.S. to India. These are all examples of different ways ecofeminist theology interacts with different contexts, but still always pushes against that logic of domination and just how that manifests itself differently in different cultures. So,
what comes to mind is the notion of systems, the systems that dominate. I was reading just last night, there's a Medicaid can come back and collect dollars that were spent to take care of somebody who's getting Medicaid. Well, guess who many of the Medicaid recipients are? They're women. And women taking care of women. So mother dies and daughter maybe was going to inherit the house, but Medicaid comes in and says, we have to collect the $175,000 that we paid out to care for your mother on Medicaid. Well, that's a system of domination, and it affects women, primarily because women live longer, and so they are going to inherit, but all of a sudden they don't because they have to repay the government system for the amount of money that was given in Medicaid. Sorry for the long treatise, but at any rate, the system domination.
Yep, that's exactly the logic of domination and how ecofeminist theology pushes back against it. So, let's see. The examples I just gave are ecofeminist theology from more of a multicultural perspective, so different cultures. Ecofeminist theology can also take place in across the religious spectrum. Unfortunately, I do not know a ton about that because I study Christian theology. But yeah, there's definitely an interfaith component in which you can sort of use these themes of ecofeminism to reach across religious lines and make connections there to move forward. And if you want resources on that, I can probably find those for you. I just personally do not know much about ecofeminist theology from specific religious perspectives. So moving on. And finally, if you read the description, you saw we will be talking about eco-womanism. Very excited to talk about that. So that is something that's more based in the U.S., kind of similar to Native women, just speaking about their rights, is eco-womanism. So, who has heard of womanism before? You have. Do you have any definition for it?
I don't know very much, but I think it's looking at the intersection of race and gender, particularly for
African-American women, or people of color. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I had a professor that argued womanism came out of a theological tradition. I'm sure other people might say differently, but yeah, she was definitely said, sort of from a Black woman's perspective. And so, the reason womanism even came about in the first place is because a lot of the early first wave, like feminist movement, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they were kind of racist. Unfortunately, they were fighting for women's rights, but when it came to people of color or the slavery, or getting rights to, I'm not sure, like rights for like African Americans to vote, they weren't into that. They're just for like white upper class women to vote. And so, in the 1960s, womanism started to crop up when the feminist movement started to get going. And a good example is women in second wave, the white women were like, hey, we want to get into the workforce and, again, break this glass ceiling, so to speak, whereas women of color were saying, we've been working this whole time either as maids or nannies, and we want a system, again, a system in which our husbands earn enough that we can stay home. So very different goals coming from very, very different perspectives and histories in the U.S. Everyone with me so far? Okay. So, yeah, womanism kind of came up as a way to say, wait a minute, feminism, you come from a very white perspective, and there's this whole other history and perspective that we need to consider.
Yes. Economically, now it's going back the other way, where both the husband and the wife usually have to work in order to survive, or, you know, for budget and everything.
Yeah, I don't think society reacted very well to women in the workforce. Came to child care and equal pay, it just didn't happen. Unfortunately, we're kind of reaping those benefits now. Or not benefits, those consequences. Yes, that's a better word for it now. So the main theologian when it comes to eco-womanism is Melanie Harris, and her book was published, her book was published in 2017, so very recent. And in it, she talks about, again, this different perspective that the black community has with the land, particularly women. And so she quotes in her book Kimberly Ruffin, who talks about the beauty and burden paradox that black women have with the environment. So this paradox is, the beauty aspect is, beauty can be found in nature. It can be very healing. You can connect through the divine through nature quite, I would argue, pretty easily. But also, there's this burden aspect in which black women, their ancestors were brought over as slaves to work the land. And they were treated horribly while working the land. And so you have this burden aspect with the land of, this is not something that is positive for me, my community. If you also think about it, a lot of lynchings were on trees. And so how does that impact how you see the natural world if you see your relatives strung up on trees and killed up in that horrific manner?
Did they ever string up women too?
Oh, yeah.
Women were lynched as well, yeah.
Yep.
I think more men, but yeah, it was definitely both.
They still stone women in Sire.
Yeah, it's...
I don't think it's as much anymore, but it does go on.
Yeah, and so... Or get myself in my notes here. So, Melanie Harris sums up this beauty and burden paradox really well in her book when she writes, "For when we compare the structural violence that ravaged the lives and raped the wombs of black women for the sake of slave master sexual gratification, and compare this with the agricultural practices of overproducing cotton in the South for the sake of a profit, thus robbing the soil of nutrients and causing soil erosion, we see the connection between violence against black women and violence against the earth." So a lot of what eco-womanism is doing is sort of unpacking this burden. A lot of what I've read is a lot of unpacking this burden aspect and sort of finally bringing to light the rapes that happened to both women and the land, and also then trying to reclaim this beauty aspect of, okay, that was this horrible part of history that still continues today through the sexualization we often have of Black women and girls, but where can they sort of find healing again in nature? So.
Man, I've heard that phrase, the rape of the land, and I never connected that to, mm-hmm. you know, to women. Duh, yeah. You know.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Some pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, it's really complex, but.
Some examples. If how you see this today is, you see this burden aspect in how inaccessible outdoor spaces are. You think here at Holden, I think most of the staff are white, most of the guests are white. Like, if you go to a national park, most people, it's a very white space, and kind of why is that? And again, that goes back to the history of, and this sort of negative connection some people of color have with the land, and also it costs money to go to these places. They're in rural places, so you need a car. There's a lot of barriers that we have built to access outdoor spaces as well. That's very important to acknowledge how that continues to live on today. And another example of this with the Native American population is a lot of, like, John Muir and the early conservationists, they were great when it came to protecting land, but they were also pretty racist people, and they kicked out a lot of indigenous populations from national park areas because they quote-unquote tainted the beauty. And so you see, yeah, just having to reconcile where do we, as white people, continue to dominate these outdoor spaces, and how can we make them more accessible and equal for all, and not a place of burden for all. And so, luckily, there's some hopeful examples. In some Black women, in particular, trying to reclaim this connection to the land and find the beauty aspect. And so, two examples are the Outdoor Journal Tour. If you want to look into these later, it was started by a couple, and it's two Black women, and they live in Atlanta, Georgia, and they lead hikes in which you walk, and then they have a meditation time, and then you journal. And I think from their website, it looks like they attract a lot of like people of color as well, particularly Black women, to come join them and sort of focus on their mental health and get out into the environment. And so that's the way they are claiming this beauty part of the beauty and burden paradox.
Gail King and her friend, and why can't I remember her friend or close friend, but multi-bazillionaire woman.
Oprah.
Gail and Oprah had, it was either a TED Talk or a program that Oprah had on going and visiting the national parks and camping. And it was funny to hear them talk about, you know, first of all, you don't see any Black people mm-hmm. out to the campgrounds or whatever, but just getting accustomed, I mean, just testing it. They had no knowledge of what was out there. It was a great program.
Yeah.
40 years ago, Holden tried to introduce some Black women from Chicago to nature mm-hmm. and to Holden. Scared the living daylights out of them. I mean, you come up here and it's totally quiet.
Oh,
you know,
well, and it's dark, and if you're from a city, dark streets are
yeah,
not safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a total change in.
Yeah, I think there are only about three groups that ever came, and it was not successful.
Oh, that's
yeah,
I first came in 1963.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't a place for city Black women to come and feel safe.
Wow.
Felt really unsafe.
Yeah, and why I think it's important to look, why do they feel unsafe?
Yeah.
And what are ways in which we can, like, have people of color come up here and sort of introduce, have the introduction be better, have them land better here so that the experience is not as negative. And also, I do want to hesitate against sort of targeting almost these minority groups and bringing them up here being like, we need diversity, so we're going to specifically talk to this group. It's like, that's still a kind of a tokenization of, well, we need the token, like, black group up here. And how do we still have, again, bring diversity into spaces like this, but not tokenize groups of people? And I do not have the answer for that. That is a really complex question, but it's something... when did you say they tried to do that?
I think it was in the 80s. I think it's like almost 40 years ago that they tried it. And
I can imagine there were still kinks to be worked out when they came to...
I don't think I've ever seen a black family here Boko years of coming.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. I last 5 years I've been volunteering at Mount St. Helens Institute. It's a big voluntary thing. And I don't recall ever seeing any black volunteers.
And so, that was interesting is the Manson Middle School group is here, and they look to be Latin American or Hispanic. I think that's maybe a way to kind of bring up the younger generations and get them more accustomed. I don't know, but it's not a perfect solution, but I think it's definitely working with school groups is could be a part of kind of reclaiming this beauty aspect of the beauty and burden paradox as well.
There's a Hispanic woman on the board of directors at Holden who mm-hmm. has been pretty, and she's from Manson or Wenatchee, someplace down lake, and she's been pretty influential in helping Holden to discover possible, ways that they might connect to the Hispanic community down lake.
Mm-hmm.
So this might be an outgrowth of that, the school groups of Manson.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And another point I want to bring up when we talk about race is it is helpful when we bring like the Hispanic woman on our board so she can kind of help direct diversity initiatives, you could say. But also we need to make sure we look into ourselves and our white community, because I was actually listening to the Holden podcast and there was some people that came and talked about race earlier this summer, and it was a black and a white guy, and the black man said, if people of color could have solved racism long ago, we would have. And like, who's the stick in the mud? It's the white population. And so I think especially with having race conversations and not tokenizing and being like, oh, well, we need a person of color to have these conversations. It's like we still need to have the conversation within our own circles as well. So, all right. So, again, to sort of sum this up, we have ecofeminism that has different perspectives and different addresses different needs of different cultures that we talked about earlier, particularly with Latin American women in India or Southeast Asia. And then in America, you have eco-womanism, which specifically looks as Nina Simone called it the black and white problem in America. And so womanism looks at that intersection of race and gender and kind of that black and white problem in America. And eco-womanism takes it a step further and looks at this beauty and burden paradox in which women and particularly black women and the land have been ravaged for either sexual gratification or overproducing cotton. So, do I have any comments or reflections on anything we've talked about thus far? Or questions?
I might mention my wife and I, we spent 4 years in Saudi Arabia in 1981-85. Mm-hmm. They have a long way to go. From a camp drive. They don't work. They might be some school teacher. My wife happened to be working as a librarian at the American School run by the airline. And she'd get a paycheck, but she couldn't go to the man's bank. She'd have to go to a woman's bank. And the woman's teller, that she didn't handle the money. She just put a slip of paper through their little slot to the other side of the room. Probably the man's bank, I guess, to get her cash, check cash. That's kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
They're just barely starting to let some woman drive now for the first time.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that country is a theocracy, I believe. So the religion, like Islam has a huge say in what happens politically.
I think it's more of a cultural thing because a lot of Islam countries, like Indonesia, they don't have all those silly religions, a lot of other Middle East countries. It's Saudi Arabia, it's a culture thing, I think.
Yeah, probably, yeah. But I was going to say eco-feminist theology would have a bigger say, perhaps, in the political movements of that country.
I would think not Saudi Arabia.
Like, well, I've been told it's a theocracy and that it's more religious-driven.
Iran is certainly has a theocracy, has a theocratic government, however it's to be described. I think about currently and what a contemporary ecofeminist would have to say about the disparity of wealth, the disparity of income with this uber-rich group here and then kind of the rest of us who are not the 1%, what ecofeminists would say about that system, that economic system. Because I heard you talk about economics, part of the ecofeminism has to do with economics, mm-hmm. because women have been at the bottom of the economic ladder forever, because yeah. males dominated. Yeah. So, but then you know, it's so complex because I don't know if it's an urban myth or not that women are going to accumulate most of the wealth because they're going to outlast the men. And so where does ecofeminism come in there? How do they get woke up?
They get more power when they have the money.
Yeah. But
so an ecofeminist, if they would happen upon like a huge inheritance, perhaps would there might be more redistribution of wealth, or perhaps using that money for environmental gain, or for women's rights organizations, or for queer rights organizations, that sort of thing.
Is it Bill and Melinda? Is that her name? Melinda Gates?
Yeah.
I think she has got to have had a huge impact on creating their foundation for the benefit of others. It's a charitable foundation, and the vast amount of their wealth will go to those causes, those interests.
Yeah, I think for sure. And a lot of studies show that when women like gain wealth, it often goes back to the community, whereas it's kind of gender difference. When men gain wealth, it tends to stay with them, within the family. So it's an interesting to think about, if women gain all this wealth, is there going to be more of a redistribution? Or I don't blame them if you come upon a lot of money. You kind of want to keep it, but yeah, like what's the more ethical thing to do, and is there going to be a shift if women start to gain more economic power? Good question.
Does justice, just the conversation about justice or the meaning of justice, enter into the conversation with ecofeminism? It's just justice? You're interested in justice, so... it's the just thing to do.
Like the ethical thing to do, or like justice against wrongs? You define justice for me.
Yes. Well, my take is both. It's both. Okay. It's the ethical thing. It's the right thing. It's the just thing to do. The domination of one over the other is not
that's the undercurrent of the whole thing.
justice.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That was
exactly.
This logic of domination.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the whole reason it started. Justice, yes.
Okay. Yeah, there's a saying, the opposite of poverty is not wealth, it is justice.
Yes. Here for that. Reflections or questions on either ecofeminism, ecowomanism, globally, what this all kind of looks like. All right, well, to kind of wrap up here, I always leave each session with a call to action. And the reason for this is that ecofeminist theology, as it stems from the feminist theology, is very concerned with everyday life. And these ideas are great. It's great to sit here and discuss them. But if it leaves this room and disappears into the air, the point is moot. You know, like, they're concerned with orthodoxy. So right thought into orthocracy. So, might be an O here. Ortho, right, praxy, practice, action, etc. So again, orthodoxy, orthopraxy. So I like to leave each session with a call to action in order for us to start to kind of flex those action muscles and how this, what we've been talking about today, can have an impact in our real lives. Okay? And so, what my call to action today comes from last fall when I was still at Candler. We went to the Legacy Museum and Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you like to explain what that is? Have you been there? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a museum that looks at the systematic racism against African Americans from slavery to Jim Crow to the mass incarceration that happens today. Pretty sobering museum, but important one to go through. And I don't know if you remember this, but part of the museum and the memorial really was kind of focused on lynchings and all the unnamed lynchings, undocumented, that happened in the U.S. And so part of what they did to memorialize lynching victims is they would go to a site where there was documented lynching, and they would get the dirt from that site and put it in a jar with the lynching victim's name and the date they were killed. And so you had this entire wall of jars with red dirt and brown dirt, because red is the southeast, and all these different names. And it was, I saw it as a very sort of tangible, like non-graphic way to really get to the point of, these were people, and these kind of what lynching had impact had. And so when I was looked at that wall of dirt, I thought about the passage we read earlier of when God confronts Cain after he murders Abel. God says, "Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And the earth continues to cry out from the suffering of African Americans and the violation of the earth that is often tied to systematic racism." And so my question for us to ponder and think about today is, what does it mean for us to cultivate better soil for the future? So what does it mean to, both in the ecological sense of cultivating soil that can still produce food and keep up and the natural environments we have all around us here at Holden, and what does it mean to cultivate better soil that where the blood of people does not cry out from it through either lynchings or other forms of systematic racism and terror. So that's my heavy question to leave y'all. Thank you for coming, and you want to talk to me after, feel free.
Did you find out where lynchings occurred in Iowa? because lynchings have occurred in every state, and I discovered that there were 3 lynchings in Duluth, Minnesota in 1926. So, and there are...
When you went to the other part of the...
Yeah.
Where the hanging...
Columns were.
And then the section where states were to take that column and go, you know, to their state. Ours is still...
It's still there.
It's still
nobody,
there.
Nobody's claimed it. Minnesota's not claimed it. You have to bring it to Duluth.
So there were duplicate columns for each state. Yeah.
I did not see one for Iowa. That does not mean it didn't happen. Just they, I believe the memorial just looked at, like, what they could find in the historical record, which is only a portion of the lynchings that happened.
The dirt may not be representative of all of the states, but the history states that lynchings occurred in every state in the Union. So that's why I didn't mean to put you on the spot for Iowa.
But we claim that there's one for Minnesota.
Yeah, we went to the museum together, and we specifically were like, let's check out the museum, and Iowa happened, but at least the none have been documented there.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that anything I had a classmate from Florida, and she looked at the county where she was from in Florida, and she's like, wow, the most recent lynching happened when her grandparents were still alive in that county.
Wow.
And I was like, whew.
Wow. That is that's recent.
Some tough stuff. That is why we have eco-womanism and feminist movement. So, yeah.
If you're worried about equal rights for women, that's for the military, Air Force especially, you're treated equal there all the way. Have any job you want. Pilots, yeah.
I'm too much of a hippie. Yeah, I've heard the Air Force is somewhat equal. Probably not the Army. Sure. I have a friend in the Army.
Pastor Doug, who is here, Pastor Doug Peterson, he's going to Long Island. One of his daughters just joined the Army and got her commission as a lieutenant and is down training right now.
I think military is tough because they're just starting to, like, on paper give women equal rights, but I mean, I think it's like 3 to 4 out of 5 women in the military are sexually assaulted at some point. So, like, the undercurrent of domination against women is still very much present.
Probably.
Even if they are promoted to higher ranking officers, what is the cost?
And even kind of the overall premise of the military is it's protection, but also in that violence towards others, which I don't think quite meshes with. It ties back to wanting to dominate others and.
It's a great opportunity for women, especially Air Force.
Yeah.
A lot of good career you can make out of.
Again, it may be a good career choice, but at what cost? Because, I mean, they own you. You are a body in their machine. And if the machine says you need to go over to this country and dominate these people, then you don't have a huge amount of say in that. So. There's some military critiques. I respect our troops, support our troops, also have some critiques against the system as a whole. So.
There's just a study, and I didn't read the whole piece. 100,000 men have been sexually assaulted or abused in the military.
Well,
but that's the system, again, of domination. So.
Yeah, and you see this in prisons a lot, too.
Yeah,
that's what I think is important for people to know about, like, rape and sexual assault is it's about domination. It's not about the sexual act in any way.
Right.
So, a lot of issues with all this theme throughout all of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. You did a wonderful job.
Yeah.
Thank you.